Every day I learn. I just got here yesterday, and I'm seeing things that I never expected to see up close and personal.
The new EPA administrator visits Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a week devoted to Arctic issues kicks off in Unalaska.
There's a lot of expertise here in the state, so we're really just trying to make sure that we benefit from that expertise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The new head of the Environmental Protection Agency is making a field trip to Alaska this week. Gina McCarthy says this trip is not about regulation, but about learning and tribal consultation. She'll be going to Fairbanks and Bristol Bay, but she started her trip at the site of a receding glacier. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
When the Visitor Center for the Portage Glacier was built in 1986, you could still look up the valley and see the glacier. But EPA head Gina McCarthy had to get on a tour boat and motor up the lake and around the corner to bring it into view. The glacier is largely perched on rocks now, with just two areas overhanging the water. The weather was beautiful, and like any tourist, she was clearly impressed with the beauty of what she saw. But she was also quick to point out that climate change is one of three issues that brought her to Alaska.
Right here, it's a beautiful sight, but in other areas, the melting of ice packs is a significant issue, primarily for drinking water.
McCarthy said President Obama wants his administration to get serious about climate change, and those are marching orders to his cabinet members. They are supposed to get out in the field and see what can be done to reduce carbon emissions, but also become more resilient.
He really made it very clear, and I'm hoping people realize this, is that the challenge of climate change is not a short-term issue. It is a long-term challenge, and one in which we need every level of government and individuals to really participate in what the solutions are. How do we make a response to this climate challenge work in a way that's healthy for the economy, as well as addressing what is perhaps the greatest threat that we have environmentally, which is climate change.
Wednesday, McCarthy will be in Fairbanks, where high fuel prices and limited access to alternatives drove many families to burning wood, which led to air pollution during cold weather atmospheric inversions. A recent court agreement has shut some of the worst offenders down. An incentive program let people swap their wood boilers out for more efficient stoves. And that is worth celebrating, she says.
And I know the mayor there and others are very active, and the state is as well, in looking at opportunities to do some wood stove changeouts. So I'm pretty excited about that. I'm excited to join the mayor because he's taken a lot of initiative here, and the state has as well.
The most controversial element of McCarthy's Alaska trip is undoubtedly her trip to the proposed Pebble Mine area. Under pressure from mine opponents, the EPA is making final a watershed assessment, which some hope and some fear will result in the federal agency using its water quality authority to ban the mine because it would put salmon runs at risk. McCarthy said it would be premature to discuss what should happen before the science is finalized.
We will finalize that in time, but I am not here to move forward. I'm here to understand what the issues are today.
Pebble was the issue reporters repeatedly probed her about, and she kept repeating that this is just a learning trip for her.
Every day I learn. I just got here yesterday, and I'm seeing things that I never expected to see up close and personal. I'm going to have that same attitude when I go there. I'm going to try to understand how they live, what they think is important. I'm going to try to understand what both a mining operation means to local constituents there, and I'm going to understand what the salmon mean to the local communities. And those are, it's just a lot about learning and understanding and being open to differing opinions, and we'll hopefully come to some decisions together on what the future means. And clearly EPA is not here to determine Alaska's future. I'm here to understand how people see their future and how our decisions mean something to them in crafting that future.
McCarthy was confirmed by the Senate a little more than a month ago. Her predecessor, Lisa Jackson, was a lightning rod for Republican opposition as she cracked the whip on air emissions. McCarthy was Jackson's air quality head, and her confirmation went largely along party lines. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The EPA administrator's visit coincides with a new poll that shows Alaskans are skeptical of the Pitt Mine, APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Hayes Research Group asked 388 likely primary voters their opinions of a possible 2014 ballot initiative that would prohibit the Pebble Mine. More than 60% say they favor the measure, and two-thirds of those respondents strongly support it. Adam Hayes conducted the poll.
Favorability was shared across all parties, Democrats, Republicans, as well as people who identified as moderate or in the middle.
This is the highest level of support for the ballot initiative ever. A clean water initiative that would have banned the mine failed in 2008, 56-44%. Hayes says Alaskans support development projects but oppose this specific one. The poll shows more than 70% of Alaskans want the gubernatorial candidates to weigh in on the ballot measure. Governor Sean Parnell has urged the EPA not to rule out the mine before the Pebble Partnership submits its application. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Legislators, scientists, and industry stakeholders are flocking to Unalaska this week to work out a plan for exploring the Arctic. And as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, they want input from locals.
The United States Arctic Research Commission convened at Unalaska's Grand Aleutian Hotel on Monday morning. The independent agency is made up of eight commissioners with diverse backgrounds in fisheries, science, and education. Their charge is to help the federal government develop a game plan for conducting research in the Arctic. The commission will talk about their research plans this week, but their focus is going to be on implementing a new National Arctic Strategy Plan released by the Coast Guard in May. That plan laid out three extremely broad goals for Arctic development: preserving peace in the region, conserving the natural environment, and finding a way to work with non-Arctic countries and organizations that want to get in on development. Brendan Kelly is a polar science director for the White House. Over the past year, that job has taken him throughout rural Alaska and now to Unalaska. He's been talking to residents about the Arctic Strategy Plan.
There's a lot of very smart people with a lot of experience, whether it's shipping or fishing or the science of the climate. There's a lot of expertise here in the state, so we're really just trying to make sure that we benefit from that expertise.
Kelly says he'll be using the testimony to help find holes in the strategy, things that the federal agencies missed or underestimated when they wrote it. On Tuesday afternoon, Kelly's holding a public hearing for Unalaskans. It's the last event before the Federal Arctic Research Commission adjourns. But the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission will pick up from there. The state legislators and local stakeholders on that board are holding their third ever meeting in Unalaska this week. They'll spend Wednesday afternoon taking public testimony before going into a work session all day on Thursday. The goal of that session is to come up with a set of guiding principles for writing Arctic policy in the legislature. The commission will also be introducing a new executive director. Nikush Carlo is a neuroscientist by training, but with roots in Alaska. She graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and she's previously worked for the state legislature. The meetings will all wrap up by Thursday evening. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a sport usually reserved for warmer waters comes to Alaska.
Heading straight for that glacier was like being in an IMAX movie for me. It's only something I've seen in movies.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Suicide prevention was the focus of about 100 tribal representatives attending the 13th Alaska Tribal Leaders Summit in Anchorage Thursday and Friday. Alaska has the nation's second highest suicide rate. In rural Alaska, suicide rates are four times the national average and involve disproportionately high numbers of young Alaska Native men. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
Ivan M. Ivan is chief of the Native community of Akiak in western Alaska.
I was born in 1945, free man.
He was one of a panel of speakers who pointed to historical trauma and rapid change, such as the loss of self-governance and of hunting and fishing rights, as factors that contribute to Alaska's high rate of suicide.
The governance that I saw was by elders, and they did it by their traditional laws, rules, and they did it quietly, their way.
Drug and alcohol abuse came up over and over. People described substance abuse as a refuge for people suffering from untreated mental illness, a slow form of suicide, and as a disease that can be overcome. Roland Andrew of Kungiganik says his village used local option laws to ban alcohol and imposed a 3% sales tax to back it up.
Without the sales tax, we started our search and seizure. All incoming passengers that are coming into my village will be sure, no matter who you are.
But several people said not enough villages are taking action. Anchorage resident Lucy Spark, who's originally from Chivac in western Alaska, says she's attended many meetings where people get charged up with hope.
But when we go home, what happens? What happens? Nothing gets done. There are people who try to do something in the village, in the villages when they go back, but nobody seemed to be listening.
Robert Sanderson Jr. of Ketchikan urged participants to help elect tribal council members who will fight to get suicide numbers down. Summit participants came up with dozens of other solutions. Bill Martin of Juneau said a locked gun safe can slow down a person long enough to change his or her mind about suicide. Russell Lamont Sr. from Emonic said something as simple as friendly attention to children can foster feelings of belonging.
They become like our own. Even little children, little ones, you go tap on the shoulder and wave at them. They recognize, well, somebody cares. So we just need to take a little moment, little time, and just recognize our children.
Other solutions included teaching people their native language, getting teenagers involved in community activities, increased public understanding of suicide risk and warning signs, and more training programs on suicide prevention and specific interventions. Tribal leaders attending the summit adopted resolutions with recommendations for action. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Wrangell Medical Center has faced a number of issues over the past few years. Finances, personal turnover, and design changes stalled the plans for building a new hospital, but now the plans are back on the table, and the hospital and its board of directors think the project is heading in the right direction. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
It's been years since the management and board of Wrangell Medical Center first proposed building a new hospital. Woody Wilson is the chairman of the WMC Board of Directors.
You know, without rehashing all of that, there was so much disagreement between the Borough Assembly and the hospital board that it just kind of got put on hold.
Marla Sanger is the interim CEO of WMC. She says that yes, Wrangell already has a hospital, and it works pretty well. But the building is getting older, and so is its technology.
Because of the age of the existing facility, there are many things that are very difficult to keep compliant with current regulatory requirements, such as
the operating rooms. Certain areas need to be maintained at specific temperatures and humidity levels.
So keeping those kinds of really finely tuned parameters is hard in a building that wasn't designed to do that.
But Woody Wilson says before anything is built, there needs to be a change in the way the hospital, the board, and the community as a whole approach the project.
And the government agencies that are going to fund us want to know that we're working in concert with one another in this community if they're going to loan us a large sum of money.
He says the hyped-up disagreements of the past have affected the project's public image.
The officials that we've talked to have all asked that question. Well, are you guys, did you stop fighting? You know, that's basically what they're asking.
And the answer is yes. Wilson says the new board of directors is functioning as a cohesive unit. He says it tries to be transparent with its discussions and decisions, and he says its relationship with the Borough Assembly is much better than it once was. Marla Sanger says it will still be a few years before the new hospital is actually built, but it is on the horizon. She says the next step is to reevaluate the original plans. That doesn't mean going back to the drawing board completely. It's just to make sure those ideas still work this many years later.
I felt it would be in the hospital and the community's best interest to take a fresh look at a couple of things that were really important to the ongoing project.
One of those is a financial contract. If the project changes, the money may as well. Another is figuring out all of the people who are actually involved in the project and what their different roles are. Sanger is an employee of Ketchikan-based Peace Health. She sent the project documents to a handful of people there who have more experience with this type of design. She says they'll be looking to see if things have changed from a regulatory standpoint or in terms of market expectations. That basically means, do the plans meet current standards? And do patients now still want and need the same things they did a few years ago?
Maybe the answer will be, well, this is really pretty good, but you could just change a little of this or a little of that and it might be better.
We just need to do our due diligence, particularly as a board and as the community, to look at this project. We need to make sure that that the finances are correct and that we're going to be able to afford what we buy, what we purchase here. You know, it's not a question of if we're going to build the hospital. It's only a question of when and how much.
Sanger says what the hospital needs most is patience. It has been a long process, but she says despite the setbacks, this hospital is for the community. So she hopes the community will play an active part in helping it finally come together. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2013 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Saturday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A Wasilla woman is under federal indictment for fraud in connection with Valley Dairy Incorporated, which did business as the now-defunct Matanuska Creamery. Karen Olson, who managed the Matanuska Creamery in Palmer, has been charged with defrauding the state of Alaska and with making false statements to the Federal Department of Agriculture. The charges stem from 2008, when Olson, CEO and part owner of Valley Dairy, allegedly obtained a $430,000 loan illegally from the state's Division of Agriculture. The charges indicate that Olson used the loan to conceal Valley Dairy's financial losses and that she made false statements to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in order to receive federal grants. Federal prosecutor Retta Randall says Olson's scheme was aimed at covering up illegal conduct on the part of her business partner.
Once she realized the economic situation of the Valley Dairy, she was made the chief executive officer of the Valley Dairy and authorized to pursue loans with the state of Alaska. What our investigation revealed is that she allegedly filed false documents by fax and by email and also by mail to get the state of Alaska loans.
Olson is charged with concealing the criminal activities of Kyle Buse, co-owner and president of Valley Dairy. Buse is currently under indictment himself for allegedly using USDA grant money for his personal use and for submitting false statements to the USDA regarding two federal grants awarded him in 2007 and 2008 to start a cheese and ice cream manufacturing facility in the Matanuska Valley. Buse is awaiting trial. Corey Mills, a state assistant attorney general in Juneau, says it is not clear at this time what action the state will take against Olson.
That's all confidential and will all be done internally. And if and when that decision is made, then it will be made public. But at this point, there's no decision on pressing charges.
The Matanuska Creamery shut down in December of last year due to financial issues. The company owed the state almost $900,000 when it closed. The state recalled its agricultural loan to Valley Dairy in August of last year after the creamery defaulted on the debt. The state acquired the creamery's assets and auctioned them off earlier this year. Federal prosecutors say that Olson could face a $1 million fine or a total sentence of 30 years in prison. When Celebrity Cruises' Millennium vessel broke down last week and had to return to Ketchikan, the company inconvenienced hundreds of passengers, canceling the rest of that trip and another scheduled Alaska cruise. And the impact goes beyond interrupted vacations. Many towns in Alaska rely on cruise passengers as a vital part of their summer income, including Talkeetna. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
According to Peter Grunwald, CEO of Premier Alaska Tours, Celebrity chartered 737s to fly some of those passengers to Anchorage, where they began their land tours as scheduled. Premier contracts with Celebrity for the land tour portion of their cruise packages. Grunwald says that while the cancellation of the rest of Millennium's schedule is disappointing, that it was fortunate that the maintenance issue did not happen earlier in the season. He also says that, overall, the summer has been spectacular, with sunny weather and a significant increase in cruise passengers. He estimates that, before the cancellation, cruise numbers were up as much as 20%. Other businesses are seeing significant impacts from the cancellations, however. Paul Landis, COO for Siri Alaska Tourism Corp., says that bookings at the Talkeetna Alaskan Lodge, which is owned by Siri, have taken a hit.
Well, obviously, it has an impact on our numbers. Both Celebrity Cruises and their parent, Royal Caribbean, are great customers of ours. And so we have to make some adjustments with the decrease in the number of room nights that we would have received from that particular sailing.
Landis says that the Talkeetna Lodge will stay open until September 15th as planned to accommodate other cruise lines and independent bookings. He says that, so far, the only employees to end their seasonal employment early have been volunteers. Landis has been working in Alaska tourism for over two decades and says that while he has dealt with cruise cancellations, that it's often due to scheduled maintenance and companies have months to prepare.
In terms of the short time frame that was put on this one, I can't recall an instance of it happening before. It really did send ripples throughout the tourism industry to all levels. But the tourism industry, as I had mentioned before, is an industry that pulls together and really works together to make sure that the guest still has a quality experience in Alaska.
In addition to the impact on land tours and lodging, the cancellation also hits the companies that provide activities to cruise passengers. Sharon Mahay of Mahay's Jet Boat Adventures says that the missing cruise passengers will hugely affect the end of the season. Mahay's had a delayed start to the season due to a late thaw and will now be facing a slowdown near the end of the summer. Talkeetna Air Taxi also says that they have had cancellations in the wake of the maintenance issues of the MV Millennium. Royal Caribbean spokeswoman Cynthia Martinez said in an email that she was not able to comment on how many passengers the Millennium would have carried on its final trip to Alaska this summer. The total capacity for the ship is over 2,000. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A group of people from all over the U.S. traveled to the capital city this week for one reason, stand-up paddleboarding. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports on this unique way of experiencing Juneau.
Jan and Jeff Lipscomb, Carol Fonches, and Bob Stafford went to Auk Lake for their first Alaska stand-up paddleboard experience. Fonches describes the sport, which has its roots in Hawaii.
It's like a big, long surfboard that you can stand on, and if you're really good, you can do yoga on or something. But with a paddle, you stand up and you just move through the water. You know, sometimes people fall in when they first start, but it's easy not to even get wet after a while.
Sunday was North Douglas. The group took off toward Mendenhall Glacier.
Heading straight for that glacier was like being in an IMAX movie for me. It's only something I've seen in movies, and to be on the water looking at it, it's really surreal.
Lipscomb says the trip so far has been fun and not too strenuous. The two couples traveled to Juneau from San Diego and Las Vegas with the help of Florida-based company Surfit. Carla Gore runs the business with her husband, Aaron Pollard. One component of her job is setting up stand-up paddleboarding trips in different parts of the world.
Almost anywhere there's water, you can paddleboard. And we're really used to warm water paddling, but I thought, we know that it's beautiful here. There's so much to see, so much water, so much place to paddle. So we thought, well, we'd just try it here.
For Jeff Lipscomb, paddleboarding in Alaska is how he wanted to celebrate turning 60.
For me, this is something that, surrealistically, you could only dream about. And it has been just 2 days in a row. All I can say is, this is phenomenal. You're paddling on the water, looking at arguably one of the most beautiful places on Earth.
Lipscomb says being on the water on a paddleboard is different than being on the water in a boat.
When you're paddling, there's the sound of your paddle in the water, and that's it. And then everything else you hear are things like eagles, birds, salmon thrashing around. You can hear and see everything with clarity.
Stafford describes the schedule for the rest of their week in Juneau.
We'll paddleboard at least once every day and maybe twice. And we'll go 5-6 miles in the morning, 5-6 miles in the afternoon. And we look for wind or some texture on the water and we follow that a little bit.
Other paddleboarding destinations in Juneau include Amalga Harbor, Boy Scout Beach, Auk Rec, and Echo Cove. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.